This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. As we gather more data on where COVID-19 cases are most prevalent, who's most vulnerable, and how we can most effectively combat the contagion, policy and protocol change as well. And it's difficult to make plans and predictions when that information changes every day. Today, we're catching up on how the state is addressing the virus right now and what tentative steps are being planned for the coming weeks. If you have questions or comments about what we can anticipate life to look like in the coming weeks, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now is State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, Brandon Smith. Brandon, thanks for coming in today.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Governor Holcomb's stay-at-home order first went into effect on March 25th, just under a month ago. And here we are, well into the fourth week of staying at home and practicing social distancing. The order has now been extended until May 1st. Brandon, this most recent extension, though, came with a little change to the policy. What changed?
Well, it's actually changed twice now. The first time he renewed it, he actually tightened some restrictions on non-essential businesses and even some essential businesses about social distancing. So, for instance, supermarkets being required to put those marks on the floor as to, okay, here you can stand when you're waiting in line, here's where the next person can stand, that sort of thing, limiting the number of customers in the store at any one time. So the first extension came with tightened restrictions. This second extension was the first time we've seen anything loosen a little bit, and I emphasize a little bit. One of the first things that the governor did with these stay-at-home orders was tell medical facilities that all non-urgent, non-essential surgical procedures, elective surgical procedures, had to come to an end. And it was a measure designed to conserve what we call PPE, that personal protective equipment, gloves, masks, gowns that healthcare systems need so badly. The idea being, if we don't need to do a surgery, let's not do it so that those supplies can be used where they're most critically needed.
Not to mention ventilators, of course.
Exactly, of course, things like that, because those are also used for some surgical procedures. This new executive order says, okay, first, healthcare facilities can bring some clinical screening and testing and treatment that doesn't require a lot of this PPE for the next week. And then next week, beginning possibly next Monday, elective surgeries can resume in Indiana. Now, that isn't for sure yet. What the state is doing right now and will continue to do through Sunday is evaluate the situation statewide. So, how many supplies do we have? What are our bed capacities? What are our ICU bed capacities? How many ventilators do we have and how many are being used? And they're tracking these things all the time, of course. But also supplies, the gloves, the masks, the gowns. Are we in a good position statewide on all of those things? If the state, if the governor's administration feels comfortable that Indiana's in a good place, then they will send out the word that starting Monday, yes, you can start doing these elective surgeries again.
And what kinds of businesses would be the first to get the green light to open when changes come next Monday, does it seem like?
Well, it's probably not going to be next Monday that we'll get more of an idea on everything else. So the stay-at-home order currently expires May 1st, which is Thursday. So sometime before then, we'll probably get the word on what the next extension, if there is one, will look like. The governor has not been specific on exactly what sort of businesses will get to reopen. What he's talked about is more broadly that businesses will have to change the way they do business, which is way more sanitizing, trying to enforce social distancing if possible at your workplace, screening employees, setting up procedures in place for if an employee gets diagnosed, if an employee is in a positive case once you reopen, and obviously they have to isolate themselves for 14 days, that you have to make sure that you have a policy in place that says that employee's not going to lose their job for that. All of these things are currently being worked out. In fact, talking here on Wednesday, April 22nd, at the end of the day today, is the sort of deadline that the governor has set for businesses and business associations across the state to send in feedback on how they think they can safely reopen, that the administration will then take the next week or so to really evaluate all of those suggestions, figure out what's feasible, and send out guidance so that when businesses start to reopen under the governor's orders, they have a very clear idea of how they're allowed to reopen, because the how is the real clincher here.
Do we have an update on testing? Have we made improvements on our capacity to test, and are we where we need to be yet at all?
Yes, we've made improvements, and I don't think anyone will tell you where we are where we need to be. No. I'm not sure. I mean, we've asked versions of this question, and we haven't gotten a straight answer from State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box, but I'm not sure Indiana will ever be in a place where every single person can get tested. That just seems unlikely. For instance, even going back to we just talked about elective surgeries might be able to resume next week. They got the question yesterday. Well, people who are asymptomatic can carry this virus. How will patients know that the doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals who are operating on them aren't asymptomatic carriers? Can we test every single healthcare worker? And the answer was no. We have absolutely expanded our testing capabilities and capacity in this state, without question, over the last few weeks. But I don't think anyone would say we are where we want to be need to be.
Dr. Box said last week that she was feeling cautiously optimistic. Why did she say that?
That's based on the numbers that they're seeing. Now, there is a bit of a disconnect between the numbers that the public can see that the State Department of Health makes available every single day on its website and the numbers that they see behind the scenes. For example, one of the key metrics that the state is tracking is hospital admissions, particularly with certain symptoms, the symptoms associated with COVID-19 and the coronavirus. We don't see those. So, for instance, Dr. Box just talked about this actually recently. At the same time that she said she felt cautiously optimistic, it was pointed out that the number of positive cases has been going up steadily, which she said, well, that's because we're testing more people. So even when we are feeling good about the trajectory of things, we're going to see more cases because we are constantly testing more people. But they're looking at deaths, they're looking at cases, they're looking at hospital admissions, they're looking at ICU beds, they're looking at ventilator usage, and the whole picture will tell them, are we doing better, are we not? And right now, based on the initial projections that the state made and then the constantly updating projections, the state is doing far better than we originally thought it would.
Lots of businesses are eager to reopen, but the governor has said that this won't be like turning on a light switch. What realistic expectations can we have of what the reopening process is going to look like?
It's going to be very gradual. A lot of those details haven't been released yet. We just talked about how the governor is asking for input from the business community. He will come out with guidelines for how businesses can reopen and what businesses can reopen. We don't know what those look like yet. But what we do know from everything he's talked about is that it will be very gradual, and it won't look like the world looked like before the coronavirus hit Indiana, at least not for the next year. Until we as a state, as a country, as a world have a vaccine that we know works, which is 12, 14, 18 months away, probably, we are not going to go back to what Holcomb has called business as usual. It is the new normal. It's a phrase he loves to use. It's the new normal. It's wearing masks in public pretty much all the time. It's wearing masks at businesses. If restaurants and bars are allowed to reopen, first of all, restaurants will probably go first because bars generally are more close contact. So bars might have to wait longer to reopen in some cases. For restaurants, it might not be, you know, it might be requiring tables to be further spaced out or maybe not allowing the entire restaurant to fill up, more closely controlling the number of people allowed in the restaurant. At businesses, like we talked about, controlling the flow of people, not being allowed to have like a cafeteria, for instance, requiring people to bring in food from home, that sort of thing the governor talked about just yesterday. So it's going to be a very gradual process, and it's not going to look like it did before this pandemic hit.
Indiana is one of seven Midwestern states that has agreed to coordinate the reopening of their economies together. Can you explain the terms of this pact and why coordination between nearby states is important?
It's very informal. There are no hard and fast terms. We are going to do this or that. But what this is the governors in the Midwest acknowledging that, for instance, if Indiana decides to reopen its businesses in any way, shape, or form before Illinois does, or before Michigan does, or Ohio or Kentucky, well, those areas on the borders now have to worry about, well, are a bunch of folks from Illinois, Michigan, Kentucky, and Ohio going to come flooding Indiana into Indiana because things are open here that aren't open at home? Yes, that is a concern that Governor Holcomb acknowledged just yesterday. So that's why there's going to be certainly a level of communication between all of the governors. You know, as he said, no governor is going to be surprised by what another state is doing in this group of seven Midwestern states. It might not mean that they will all do things at the same speed, at the same pace, at the same time, but it will mean that they will have a heads up about it and that they will talk about it and try and come to a place where they all feel comfortable with what each other are doing.
How has Governor Holcomb's approach to addressing the virus compared to the strategies of those other governors or other governors outside of our Midwestern region?
Well, that answer changes dramatically depending on who you're asking about. In terms of the Midwest, we have seen fairly similar actions by a lot of the governors in that group of seven. Eric Holcomb was certainly on the forefront of Republican governors. Democratic governors early on took a lot more stringent steps than their Republican counterparts. But Eric Holcomb was one of very few Republicans who really was out in front on the stay-at-home orders and things like that. Now, when you go outside of the Midwest, it looks radically different. Obviously, New York and California have their own things, the Northwest in general. We've seen things like Georgia now, where they're just opening everything back up, which Eric Holcomb was very diplomatic in not criticizing yesterday when asked about it, but acknowledged that he is in a very different situation. So I would say that Eric Holcomb has gotten praise, generally speaking, for being certainly at the forefront with a lot of other governors in this area, at least.
Brandon Smith is Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter. Brandon, thanks for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we'll talk to an epidemiologist about whether or not Indiana is, in fact, flattening the curve. And the president of the Community Physician Network is going to give us an update on how hospitals and doctors' offices are doing on supplies, staffing, and morale right now. And are they prepared for potential future spikes? As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. What questions do you have about what we can anticipate in the coming weeks? We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we are back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about what progress Indiana has made in the battle against coronavirus and what more needs to be done moving forward. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, to 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. We're joined now by the president of the Community Physician Network, Dr. John Kunzer. Dr. Kunzer, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, glad to be here, Matt.
We're also welcoming the Director of Epidemiology Education at Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, Tom Dusinski. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So, Tom, you've joined us on the show several times in the past few weeks as the pandemic has unfolded. You described the job as an epidemiologist as a disease detective, and if we ever needed to talk to one of those, it's now. So thank you for continuing to share your expertise. And we've mentioned that Governor Holcomb's stay-at-home order has been in effect now for 4 weeks. The goal of physically distancing ourselves is, of course, to slow the spread of the virus. Tom, are we flattening the curve?
Like Dr. Bach said, I'm cautiously optimistic at this point. This is about the time where we expect to see that kind of flattening or at least a slowing of the number of cases in the state. And, you know, going day by day, it's difficult to see that. But when we start, you know, looking out over weeks, we could start to see that turn a little bit. And we have to approach that with real caution, though. We can't say, okay, great, we're now out of the woods. We've flattened it. And all that really means is, look, we're about halfway through, right? We still have to go all the way back down, and we're not there yet.
So we haven't yet reached our peak of cases yet?
I don't know if we've reached our peak of cases in Indiana, because it's every day we're getting more cases being reported, obviously. But sometimes it's hard to say when we batch cases and things like that. So we get like a bolus of new cases reported all at once that represents multiple days or maybe even a week's time.
Is there a surge to come, perhaps?
I hope not. I don't believe there is. I think that we might be coming out of that potential for a really large surge. But we're watching states like New York that have gone through this or are a little bit ahead of us in the timeline. And they saw a little bit of flattening start to occur before they had a tremendous surge. That's why we're cautiously optimistic at this point.
And we won't know the peak, of course, until it's passed. What were the early predictions of how the virus would hit Indiana, and how is that different or similar to how things have played out?
Early predictions were that, you know, without social distancing, we were going to have just a lot of what we call morbidity and mortality, right? Sickness and death, more than our capacity as a state to respond could handle. With social distancing, this is about the time we're going to see that flattening. Because of that social distancing, that's what's going to cause this flattening. And it's about the time we should be seeing this, because with a long incubation period, which could be as long as 14 days for this disease, it's going to take time to see that effect. The other thing that we have to be cautious about is that, you know, we had things like the Easter holiday. Did people go out and gather when they shouldn't have? If that's the case, then we expect to see a little bit of spike from those situations. I've heard stories of people getting their stimulus checks and then going shopping for non-essential items, which could then increase your exposure. So we might even see a peak from that as well.
Mm. Dr. Kunzer, as the president of the Community Physician Network, can you talk about what your role and responsibilities are?
Yeah, I oversee our Community Physician Network, which is the employed group of physicians and advanced practice providers that work at Community Health Network here in Indianapolis and in Anderson and Kokomo. We have about 1,300 providers.
So if we rewind a few weeks to when hospitals and doctors' offices first started encountering cases of the coronavirus, COVID-19, we know that a lot of changes happened very quickly to effectively treat patients and mitigate the spread. Now that we're a few weeks in, do doctors and nurses feel like they've found a rhythm, or is this still new territory?
Oh, it's definitely still new territory, but I think we've had a moment to catch our breath. I think if you rewind to a couple weeks ago, there was significant concern that this curve or this surge that we would see could overwhelm the capacity of the healthcare system. And just as Tom was saying, clearly these interventions of social distancing are working and are slowing that spread. So I think we are at a kind of, if you will, on the inpatient side, at kind of a steady state. And now we have to look at, you know, what does that new normal that your previous guest was talking about? And some of the actions that we took early on were to consolidate our primary care and MedCheck offices, to limit the number of in-person visits and really to switch to virtual. We stopped doing, as others did, elective cases. And so now we have to look towards the future and say, what does that new normal look like as we try and bring some of those services back on? Line.
We know that a lot of medical providers have been dealing with shortages of PPE, personal protective equipment. Is this still a challenge your healthcare workers are facing?
Luckily, right now, no. Early on, again, there was significant concern of would we have the PPE to meet these worst case scenarios, and there was significant concern. But a tremendous amount of work by our supply chain folks, sourcing every possible avenue and new avenues in some Indiana businesses that have helped out in making gowns and masks. So no, we now are in a very good place with PPE. With that said, though, as we looked again towards the future and bringing back other services back online, we have to do that with, number one, safety is our first priority for patients and caregivers. And related to that is clearly making sure we always maintain a sufficient supply of this personal protective equipment. So we monitor that daily, but we're in a good place right now.
How has your capacity to test patients for the coronavirus changed since the first few cases? Do you have access to more tests? And are you able to get the results of those tests any faster than before?
Yes, than before. So we are able to test symptomatic patients and caregivers and high-risk individuals. Eli Lilly has really done a tremendous job stepping in for Indiana as well. And then our different labs are now able to do those. You can get tests now as quick as 24 hours. But clearly, testing is not where we need it to be. I'm sure Tom, the epidemiologist, would love to test everybody in Indiana, and we just don't have that number of tests available because of limitations of the number of swabs and testing reagents. So, yep, we are in a better place with testing, but clearly not where we need to be, and we need to do a lot more testing when those resources become available.
Tom, can you explain the relationship between our ability to test for coronavirus and our ability to make any solid plans about how we can move forward?
Yeah, testing is absolutely key, without question. And you're correct. I want to test everybody in the state as an epidemiologist. That helps us understand what we call the penetrance, right? How much disease or even prevalence, how much disease exists in the state of Indiana. That helps us kind of calculate rates of sickness and rates of death in the population to help us understand just how bad of a disease is this overall or how mild it can be. So that's definitely going to be key to, I think, reopening the state is understanding how much disease. The other thing it does is if we can do serology testing, this idea where people that have recovered should have what we call antibodies or these little proteins that help protect you from reinfection. Now, we don't know clearly if reinfection is possible with this, but serology testing helps us understand who was infected and do they have some level of immunity to reinfection. This would certainly help understand how we could reopen the economy in Indiana by saying, okay, this is how much disease existed in the state. These are how many people that have what we think is going to be immunity to this disease. And then we could start reopening some non-essential businesses and kind of do it in reverse order that we implemented them, right? So if restaurants and bars were the first to close, they might be some of the last ones to open.
We're talking about the progress Indiana has made in the battle against the coronavirus, and we're on the phone with the Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, Tom Tyczynski, and we also have the President of the Community Physician Network, Dr. John Kuntzer, on the line with us as well. Tom, discussions about when to reopen the economy are underway. We just touched on a little bit of that, but the governor has extended the order, the stay-at-home order, through May 1st. So hypothetically, from an epidemiologist perspective, if we were to lift all restrictions, you talked about phasing them in, but if we were to lift all restrictions the way some people have expressed that they want, especially in the protests this past weekend, if we were to lift all the restrictions the next day, May 2nd, and get back to business as usual, what would the consequences be?
I think we'd see a second spike in the population. The whole idea behind staying at home and minimizing or eliminating non-essential businesses during this lockdown phase was to protect people from being infected, especially the most vulnerable people, right? Those that are elderly or have immunocompromising conditions like cardiovascular disease or hypertension and such. By keeping people at home, we've protected them from being infected. We open the doors all at once for everything. We would start to see those infections go back up, and we would have more people being hospitalized and those with severe outcomes.
So we know that a lot of people want to get back to normal, but we know that the extreme of that is in the minority for sure. But everyone is eager to see us get back to some semblance of normalcy. If we can't determine a date on the calendar to act as a green light to reopen businesses, what indicators are we looking for to act as our cue?
I think one of the big things we're looking for is a drop in the number of cases across the state. Some of that is going to be a timing issue because not all parts of the state are at the same time period of infection, right? So Indianapolis definitely got a higher peak sooner than maybe, say, like Evansville or Fort Wayne or Lake County, City of Gary area. They might be a little bit behind where Indianapolis currently is. So I think we're gonna look at that a little bit. I think the second thing we need to be doing is just contact tracing for when we reopen these things, right? When we start reopening this, if we have enough testing, we could test those individuals. We can identify those that are currently actively ill versus those that were previously infected. And then we could do contact tracing on those ill individuals to ensure that we put a wrap around them to protect other people from being infected.
Dr. Kunzer, sufficient healthcare capacity to handle resurgence is on the governor's list of considerations about how to move forward. Is talk of reopening the economy something that makes healthcare professionals nervous in anticipation of future waves of cases?
Absolutely. If we do it too fast and if we don't do it in a thoughtful manner, I think there's absolutely the risk that we could see a second spike. And, you know, I totally get where people are coming from of they want to get back to work. They want to get out of their house. They want to try and get back to, quote unquote, normal as soon as they can. But, I mean, we just have to remember we are talking about human beings' lives. You know, although things have slowed, I mean, I think the state reported it was like 34 deaths today. We know that these measures, the social distancing, worked, and we have the data to show it because of we did not see as worst-case scenario as we would have seen a month ago. So we just have to keep reminding folks that we are all in this together and to really protect one another, to protect our parents, our loved ones. We have to do this cautiously. We have to do it slowly, and we have to follow the data. So as we slowly reopen, and as the governor has advised, we just weekly have to be looking at the number of cases, the number of admissions, how our PPE is. So slow is better in this scenario.
Have you seen cases in healthcare professionals testing positive for COVID-19? And if so, how has that affected staffing?
Yeah, we have. So we have we've had about 17% of our workforce that we've tested. So we've tested about a little over 1,000 and have come back positive. Interestingly, we see most of those, though, that are positive are not due to a known exposure, i.e. this personal protective equipment works, minimizes folks' exposure. So, you know, the hypothesis is that these very well may be exposures people are getting outside of the hospital from asymptomatic folks. But yeah, it clearly affects our staffing because when somebody's positive, we have to have them self-quarantine until they're symptom-free. So, yeah.
Do you feel like our hospitals and doctors' offices will be adequately prepared for future resurgence?
Yes, now I do, because I think because of, you know, I think as a country and as a state, we weren't as prepared as we needed to be for this. And, you know, the national numbers are for every dollar we spend in healthcare, we spend about 60 cents in public health. If you look at other industrialized nations, for every dollar they spend in healthcare, they spend $2 in public health. So, I think this was the awakening we needed to know. And so we all now have plans in place for emergency preparedness. So should we see a second spike or surge in the fall, you know, I think we will be ready.
Tom, we've got a little more than a minute left. We know that estimates of when we'll have a vaccine range anywhere from 18 months to 5 years, maybe longer. What do you predict life in this limbo stage is going to look like?
Well, we have to understand if whether or not people that are currently ill or had been ill actually have long-term immunity to this. We don't know that yet, so I think that's going to be really important. Until a vaccine becomes available or necessary, we're going to have to maintain this social distancing to a degree. We're going to have to, you know, maintain that good hand washing that we've been preaching for so long now, staying home when you're sick, you know, making sure that you're reaching out to your healthcare professionals when you are ill, and testing is still going to be a priority.
And so very quickly, I guess, how long are we, how long in a realistic and careful sense, just give me a number, can we expect to be taking any kind of precaution? When will that be lifted completely?
That's a really difficult question to answer. You know, from an epidemiological standpoint, an infectious disease person, never. But for the general public, you know, that the idea of, you know, getting back to some normalcy, it's definitely going to be a year down the road at the very minimum or longer.
Tom Dzinski is Director of Epidemiology Education at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity again.
Dr. John Kuntzer is President of Community Physician Network. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, man.
I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our progress report on how Indiana has been able to address COVID-19 so far and how life will continue to be affected in the coming weeks. We've talked about where we are in the fight against the virus itself, and now let's turn to where we stand economically. We're joined now by the Associate Dean of Academic Programs at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business in Indianapolis, Phil Powell. Phil, thanks for being with us today.
Good to be here.
And as always, we would love your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. All right, Phil, well, we're at over 100,000 unemployment insurance claims that have been made every week in Indiana since the last week in March. And those numbers from the state's Department of Workforce Development don't even capture the full story of the economic hardship that so many are experiencing. Can you give us some context about the economic moment we're in right now in comparison to other recessions we've experienced? How does this compare?
Since the Great Depression, we've never had unemployment this high. Our projection right now is that this unemployment could go as high as about 19%, both in the state and in the country. Now, people ask, are we going to be in another Great Depression? The answer is no, and I'll circle back on that. But in the Great Depression, in the late 20s and early 30s, unemployment got as high as 25%. So we're not going to hit that. The big difference is stimulus, both from the Federal Reserve and the federal government. And while we're going to see this huge spike in joblessness, the trillions of dollars that are being pumped into the economy are going to have a huge impact. It's just going to be a delayed impact. Also, I think the good news is that this recession is not caused by economic fundamentals. It's caused by public health fundamentals. Before we went into this, the economy was in very good shape. And that bodes well for a bounce back as we are able to lift the social controls. So the recovery could be much quicker than we're used to after a recession, but still not quick enough.
The fact that this was such a sudden onset, you know, that all of this has happened in the course of now a month and a half, does that not help, or is that really a variable that's worth considering at all?
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that when we can't get together, we can't conduct commerce. And when you can't conduct commerce, when you can't trade goods or services, people don't make an income and you can't pay your employees. So I think as quickly as it disappeared, again, it all depends on the on the disease, but as social controls are listed, we will see a quick return. So I think the quickness of the drop actually bodes well for a quickness of a rebound. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to get back to where we were. It could take 18 months to get there, because a lot of folks, a lot of businesses are not going to survive this. They're going to have to go bankrupt. And that's going to be the real loss that the Indiana economy and everywhere else in the United States is going to suffer.
Well, I think you may have just answered my next question. Are we through the worst of it when it comes to layoffs and job loss, or is there more to come? I guess time will tell.
Well, we'll have another jobs report coming. I think that there's some consensus among economists that we'll continue to see some loss. I mean, right now we're sitting at about an effective rate of about 17% unemployment. And we might have another 2 or 3 points to go. You could get as bad as 19 or 20%. So I think we will continue to see some losses. We've probably seen the peak loss. And then again, when social controls are lifted, there are certain sectors that can get right back to business. So yes, I think the worst is over in terms of the loss, but there's still going to be a lot of workers out there that are especially in industries that can't get back to business until we're in an advanced stage of reversal of the disease that are going to be hurting. And that hurt is going to be on a large scale, and it's going to be on a scale and a depth that we didn't see in 2008.
Small businesses are some of the most vulnerable right now, and the U.S. Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program seemed to offer a lot of hope until the money ran out. Can you talk about how this program was designed to work, and then what happened?
Well, fundamentally, this program, I like the design in that it was designed to let businesses call a timeout and keep people employed. It was $500 million. That's just not enough. Now, I think in Washington, the Senate just may have approved a second round. They're calling it stage 3.5 of the stimulus. But from a design perspective, it's good in that you give these small businesses, in theory — now there's a difference between theory and practice — but in theory, you give these businesses enough cash to just call a timeout, keep their employees somewhat employed, so that they can sort of go into hibernation until business comes back. And the design is good. It's just that we've quickly discovered that there wasn't enough liquidity to go around. And hopefully Washington is addressing that as we speak.
While there were funds in the program, who got them? Was it just a first come, first serve kind of thing?
Well, it was a scramble. It was a scramble for money. And the federal government had to put very quick processes in place, and there's no way it could have been a perfect process. So it also depended upon local communities. I mean, for example, in Indianapolis, the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce quickly put in place the Rapid Response Hub, which was one of the few chambers in the country to do it. And by doing so, and by helping the federal government in that outreach to small businesses, we see that small businesses in the Indianapolis area, in terms of numbers, relative numbers, were probably had better access than in other cities that didn't have as strong a community network of support. Still, though, there are businesses in Indianapolis and Indiana that follow the rules and just haven't gotten their money yet. And that is that's painful. It's a painful reality. And I know that the state government, I know that Governor Holcomb's administration and the federal government is doing all they can to break the bottlenecks. This is a huge operational undertaking, and it's just not enough yet.
Indiana has a significant manufacturing sector. Can you talk about what it means to pause manufacturing in this state and the ripple effects that causes?
Well, pausing manufacturing is a little different than if you pause restaurants. Services are very much about your location and your labor force working. When you're dealing with manufacturing, you have the added cost and the added complexity of your machinery and equipment. And so if you shut a factory down, there's huge costs there. So if a manufacturing company has to shut down, they have a disproportionate impact in terms of their costs, which can really hurt them financially. because they're having to pay for the shutdown. They're having to maintain that equipment while it's shut down. In the meantime, they're earning no revenue and no production. And then they'll have to incur more costs to ramp up. And then they'll have to work their machines. And maybe a good problem to have, they'll have to, when things do recover, they'll have to kick into overtime to refill the supply chains and refill pent-up demand. And this start-stop process can be very expensive, and it can lengthen the time that it takes for a manufacturing firm to financially recover. That's why you see a lot of the manufacturing firms much more hesitant to shut down. They try to figure out either how to slow production, in the hopes is that they might continue producing, they can shore up inventories so that when the economy does recover, you know, they can sort of smooth out the impact. Manufacturing firms have the ability to do that, whereas restaurants don't. That might be one advantage of manufacturing. But, you know, most of our manufacturing jobs in Indiana are very well-paid positions. A lot of them are relocated in small communities. If a community has one or two manufacturing plants at the heart of the economy, it can cripple very quickly a rural county. And I know that's something the governor's office is concerned about.
We're taking a progress report on how Indiana's been able to address COVID-19 so far. In this segment, we're talking about the economy, and we're joined by Associate Dean of Academic Programs at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business in Indianapolis, Phil Powell. Phil, so we know that the coronavirus is on different trajectories in other countries. What can we learn about what an economic recovery might look like from countries that are a few steps ahead of us?
Well, I think that if you look at this, when I put my economist cap on, I see this as a three-stage process. We're into 4 weeks of a 12-week period of economic paralysis. And so I think that while we may open up a little bit in mid-May, I think for those who are listening and those who are small business owners, you just need to accept 3 months of just absolute paralysis economically. That would be followed. So that takes us, what, through June? Hmm. And then you have another 3 months of this small crawl-out process where we kind of reach a new equilibrium, a new normal, and things are starting to, you know, business is starting to crawl out, but at a pace that we still don't think is fast enough, but there is traction there. And then after about 6 months of this, then we enter real recovery. And that's when we start to see bounce back. Now that assumes no measurable second peak. And of course that's the big elephant in the room right now. Are we going to see another spike like we did? Are we going to see another spike in September, October? That is just as bad as now. And there's huge debate among that in the public health community, and I defer to their expertise. But if there is a big second peak in September, October, that could be very catastrophic for us. It's the big fear. But I think right now, you know, I think it's important for business owners to understand that, you know, the panic period is over. And now it's time to prepare for your relaunch. It's going to come. And prepare for your relaunch and try to buy yourself financial time with renegotiating some of your cash obligations. But I think, you know, I think this episode is really well timed because we're past this panic period, and it's really about shoring up to prepare for business to come back.
We know the governor is in conversation with businesses across the state about how to reopen. What protective measures do you think will be critical here?
Well, I think I would mirror the previous guests that talked about how, you know, you've got businesses may open up again, but they've got to incur the cost, which is not only financial cost, but also you might have to reduce the traffic of your customers for social distancing, you know, and, you know, there's physical separation first. And then there's also how do you establish sort of emotional security, both for your workers and for your clients. And that could differ from business to business. That could differ from industry to industry. But the challenge here is as much emotional and psychological as it is physical. And I think that part of this planning process for relaunch is that business owners need to really think about this, that those customers coming back are going to, you know, have a different mentality than, you know, they might be your most loyal customers, but their mind is in a different place. And you've got to accommodate that. So some of the adjustment is going to be, we're going to move at the business time frame. It's great for the governor and the government to say, hey, you can reopen. But as markets work, it's going to naturally occur depending upon the people that you serve and the types of industries that you're in.
But there are other variables here too, right? Other transformations that we might anticipate, like supply chains, will they need to be reevaluated? Will some work from home practices be adopted more long term, do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, there's been some there's been a lot of pain. But when you're forced to do things differently, businesses sort of trip over some things that they discover that to make them more productive. Actually, the literature says that if you design the right culture in an organization, working from home can increase productivity for an employee by 30 or 40%. Supply chains, I think the issue with supply chains are, in general, that it's going to just take a while to get them reestablished. Those that cross international borders, and there's a lot that do in Indiana, especially because of manufacturing, both in terms of serving supply chains that extend into the international economy and the international economy feeding our businesses in Indiana, that's going to take a lot longer to get back to where it should be. And I think that a lot of the assumptions about just-in-time manufacturing, keeping low inventories, always gravitating toward low-cost sources, we're definitely going to see a reconsideration of that across the board in industries. And I think, to your point earlier, especially in the manufacturing sector, if for those industries that have very complex global supply chains.
Can you explain which industries are going to be able to snap back fairly easily and then maybe which ones are going to have a harder time?
Sure. I mean, I think those industries that serve where customers come from the local economy, right? So let's take Indianapolis, for example, in the restaurant and in hospitality industry. There are businesses in Indianapolis. There are restaurants in Indianapolis that really almost 100% of their clientele are from within their community. Whereas those that serve the Convention Bureau or tourism, you know, we're not going to see a return. We're not going to see a return of cross-state travel for a while. So businesses that serve their local community the most in terms of clientele are probably going to be able to bounce back the quickest. Now, in terms of industries, I think manufacturing will come back, you know, and we're going to see the finance sector, definitely the healthcare and life sciences sector, both two very important sectors in many different parts of the state, are going to bounce back more quickly. I think what's going to hurt the most and take the longest to bounce back will be travel. It will be, of course, convention business. And then anything that sort of serves is sort of goods or services are sort of considered luxury items. People are, even if they have their money, they're not going to be spending it because of fear. And we see that in any recession in that those that sell goods and services that are fed by discretionary income, their businesses goes down the most, and they're the last to recover.
Phil Powell is the Associate Dean of Academic Programs at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business in Indianapolis. Phil, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe and catch up if you've got some time. Tomorrow, we'll revisit a popular conversation about the birds of Indiana. No COVID talk tomorrow. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. In the meantime, I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.